the plain of Jars, Laos. In the remote, rugged highlands of north-central Laos, scattered across hundreds of square kilometers of bomb-cratered landscape, lies one of archaeology's most profound and haunting enigmas, the Plain of Jars. This is not a metaphor. It is a literal description of thousands of colossal, prehistoric stone jars, some towering over 3 meters high and weighing more than a dozen tons. They litter the plateaus and foothills of Xiangkhouang province, silent sentinels to a civilization that vanished thousands of years ago, leaving behind no written records, no identifiable settlements, and no clear explanation for their monumental efforts. The scale is staggering. Over 90 distinct sites have been cataloged, each containing anywhere from 1 to 400 of these megalithic vessels. Carved from solid rock, sandstone, granite, conglomerate, and limestone, they are a testament to incredible ambition and technical skill. Quarries have been found, sometimes 10 kilometers from the jar sites, raising the immediate and daunting question of transportation. How did a Bronze or Iron Age people, with no apparent access to wheels or advanced machinery, move multi-ton quarried stone across treacherous, hilly terrain? The sheer logistics are mind-boggling, suggesting a society with a powerful, centralized authority capable of organizing and commanding immense labor over generations. The purpose of the jars is the core of the mystery. Local legends, passed down through centuries, speak of a race of giants who once inhabited the region. Their king, Kun Chung, after a great victory, supposedly commissioned the creation of the jars to brew and store vast quantities of Lao Lao, a potent rice wine, for a celebratory feast. While a romantic notion, it fails to account for the archaeological evidence. The most prominent scientific theory, supported by discoveries made over the last century, points to a far more somber purpose. The jars were likely part of a complex and sophisticated mortuary practice. Excavations led by French archaeologist Madeleine Colani in the 1930s, and more recent studies by international teams, have unearthed human remains, burial beads, and bone fragments, both inside and around the jars. This has led to a multi-stage burial hypothesis. The theory posits that the jars were used as initial decomposition vessels. A body would be placed inside, perhaps with ritualistic items, and left to decay until only the bones remained. This process, known as excarnation, is not unique in human history. Once the flesh was gone, the bones would be retrieved, bundled, and buried in a secondary location, often in marked graves surrounding the jars themselves. Some jars are even fitted with stone lids, though most have been lost to time, which would have been essential for containing the decomposition process. Adding weight to this theory are discoveries of underground burial chambers and cremated remains, suggesting a variety of funerary rites were practiced concurrently. Yet, this explanation, while plausible, is incomplete. It doesn't explain the sheer variation in jar size and shape. It doesn't explain why some sites have hundreds of jars while others have only a few. And it doesn't explain the mysterious disc-shaped stones found at some sites, many carved with concentric circles or stylized human figures, which don't appear to be simple lids. Are these grave markers? Ritualistic altars? Astronomical calendars? The code remains unbroken. The story is further complicated by the tragic modern history of the region. During the Vietnam War, Laos became the most heavily bombed country per capita in human history. The Plain of Jars was a strategic area and was carpet-bombed relentlessly. Unexploded ordnance still contaminates the landscape, making comprehensive archaeological surveys incredibly dangerous and slow. We are left to wonder what secrets were destroyed, what clues were obliterated before they could ever be studied, buried alongside the ancient dead by a war they could never have imagined. The Plain of Jars is not just an archaeological mystery. It is a landscape of layered tragedy, a place where the riddles of a lost civilization are interwoven with the scars of a modern conflict. The Hoia Bachu Forest, Romania. West of the city of Cluj-Napoca in Transylvania, Romania, lies a forest that has earned a reputation as one of the most paranormally active and unsettling places on Earth. This is the Hoia Bachu Forest, often called the Bermuda Triangle of Transylvania. For over half a century, it has been a hotspot for unexplained phenomena, attracting ghost hunters, ufologists, and scientists alike, all seeking to understand the strange energy that seems to permeate its twisted, unnaturally shaped trees. The forest is a place where the line between folklore, psychology, and tangible physical anomaly becomes profoundly blurred. The forest's notoriety began in the 1960s. In 1968, biologist Alexandru Sift, who had been studying the forest's strange phenomena for years, captured a series of photographs of a saucer-shaped object flying over the canopy. That same year, a military technician named Emil Barnia, ignoring government warnings against acknowledging such things, photographed a similar disc-like object. These images, authenticated at the time and still debated today, catapulted Hoya Bachu into the international spotlight. But UFOs are only one facet of its mystery. The forest itself is visually disturbing. Many of the trees grow in bizarre, twisted patterns, spiraling trunks, bent at sharp 90-degree angles, or growing in interwoven corkscrew formations. This phenomenon is not uniform. It is concentrated in certain areas, while adjacent trees grow perfectly straight. Soil analysis has failed to identify any chemical or radioactive cause for these deformities. At the heart of the forest is a perfect circular clearing in the trees, a patch of ground where, inexplicably, nothing will grow. Soil samples from this clearing have been tested repeatedly, and they show no abnormalities that would prevent plant life. Yet, for as long as anyone can remember, it has remained a barren, eerie circle. Local legends claim it is the home of whatever entity haunts the woods, and that it is a gateway to another dimension. Visitors to Hoya Bachu report a bewildering array of experiences. Many feel an intense, inexplicable sense of anxiety or dread upon entering. They report sudden nausea, debilitating headaches, and the feeling of being watched by unseen eyes. More disturbingly, people have emerged from the forest with unexplained rashes, scratches, and burns, appearing on their skin despite having no memory of injury. Another common phenomenon is the experience of lost time. Individuals or groups will enter the forest for what they believe is an hour, only to emerge and find that many hours, or in some legendary cases, days, have passed. The paranormal activity is even more direct. Disembodied voices are frequently heard, sometimes captured on audio recordings. Apparitions, shadowy figures, green eyes floating in the dark, and spectral mists are regularly sighted. Electronic equipment is known to malfunction without cause. Batteries drain instantly, and GPS systems fail. It is this potent combination of physical anomalies, physiological effects, and paranormal encounters that makes Hoya Bachu so compelling. Skeptics offer rational explanations. The twisted trees could be the result of a unique microclimate, disease, or unusual snow patterns from when they were saplings. The physiological effects could be attributed to infrasound, low-frequency sound below the range of human hearing that can cause feelings of anxiety, nausea, and dread. The forest's topography could naturally produce such sounds. The paranormal sightings could be products of suggestion and mass hysteria. People go into a haunted forest expecting to see ghosts, and their brains obligingly create them. The UFOs could be misidentified conventional aircraft, weather balloons, or simply hoaxes. Yet no single explanation has managed to account for the sheer breadth and consistency of the phenomena reported over decades by thousands of independent witnesses. The forest remains a living laboratory of the unexplained, a place that challenges our understanding of the natural world and the very limits of human perception. The Yonaguni Monument, Japan. In 1986, a local diver named Kihachiro Aratake was exploring the waters off the coast of Yonaguni, the southernmost of the Ryukyu Islands of Japan. He was scouting for new hammerhead shark watching spots when he stumbled upon something that would ignite one of the fiercest debates in modern archaeology. Submerged 25 meters below the ocean's surface was a colossal, monolithic rock structure, a series of immense terraced platforms, sharp right angles, and towering stepped pyramids that looked for all the world like a sunken city. This is the Yonaguni Monument, and its discovery poses a fundamental question. Is this a breathtakingly complex natural geological formation, or is it the definitive proof of a lost, sophisticated civilization from the depths of prehistory? The structure is immense, measuring approximately 100 meters long by 60 meters wide, and rising 25 meters from the seabed. Its features are strikingly geometric. There is a formation known as the Turtle, a large, low platform with a distinct shape. There are what appear to be carved staircases, looping terraces, and two enormous parallel megaliths that look like pillars. The most impressive feature is a massive rectangular platform, often called the main terrace or the pyramid, which rises in a series of 1 meter high steps to a flat top. The precision of its right angles and the symmetry of its design seem to defy a natural origin. The primary proponent of the man-made theory is Masaaki Kimura, a marine geologist from the University of the Ryukyus. After decades of dives and detailed mapping, Kimura is convinced that Yonaguni is an artificial structure, a remnant of a lost Pacific civilization, a Japanese Atlantis, perhaps the legendary civilization of Mu. He points to what he identifies as tool marks on the stone, drainage channels, and even a primitive form of writing or pictograms carved into the rock face. He argues that the structure's separation from the main rock mass of the island is evidence of quarrying. His theory suggests the city was built on dry land during the last ice age, around 10,000 BCE, when sea levels were significantly lower. As the ice caps melted, the sea rose, inundating the city and preserving it in a watery grave. If true, this would radically rewrite human history, proving the existence of a complex, monument-building civilization thousands of years before the accepted timelines of Egypt or Mesopotamia. However, the mainstream scientific and geological community remains deeply skeptical. Geologists like Robert Schoch, famous for his work on the Great Sphinx of Giza, argue that the monument is a purely natural phenomenon. The rock type at Yonaguni is sandstone, which is known to fracture along straight, clean plains, naturally creating the blocky, terraced effect. Schoch contends that these staircases and terraces are simply the result of millennia of erosion, from strong ocean currents acting on a well-bedded sedimentary rock formation. The apparent symmetry and geometry, he argues, are a classic case of pareidolia, the human brain's tendency to perceive meaningful patterns in random data. He points out that the structure is still physically connected to the underlying rock mass of the island, which contradicts the quarrying theory. The tool marks and carvings identified by Kimura are, in Schoch's view, nothing more than natural scratches and depressions in the rock. The debate is a perfect clash of perspectives. To the believers, Yonaguni is a place of wonder, a tangible link to a forgotten chapter of human history. They see intention, design, and artistry in its forms. To the skeptics, it is a geological marvel, a stunning example of how natural forces can mimic human craftsmanship, and a cautionary tale about the allure of a good story. Without any definitive artifacts, no pottery, no metal tools, no bones, found directly on the structure, the mystery endures. It remains suspended in the deep blue water, a silent stone Rorschach test, where one person sees the hand of God or man, and another sees only the patient, powerful work of the sea. Racetrack Playa, Death Valley, USA. In a remote, bone-dry lake bed nestled high in the mountains of Death Valley National Park lies one of nature's most perplexing and whimsical mysteries, the sailing stones of Racetrack Playa. Here, on the cracked, barren floor of the playa, rocks, some weighing as much as 320 kilograms, 700 pounds, appear to move on their own, propelled by an invisible force, leaving long, distinct tracks etched into the dried mud behind them. For decades, the phenomenon baffled scientists and fueled speculation, with theories ranging from magnetic fields and hurricane-force winds to outright paranormal intervention. The tracks are the undeniable evidence. They are often hundreds of feet long, perfectly incised into the playa's surface. The paths are varied and complex. Some are straight, some are gracefully curved, and some show sharp, angular turns, as if the rock abruptly changed its mind. Sometimes multiple rocks will travel in near-perfect parallel, their tracks like synchronized swimmers. Others will start together, travel in unison for a distance, and then veer off in completely different directions. The mystery was twofold. What force was powerful enough to move such heavy rocks, and what mechanism allowed them to carve such precise, delicate tracks without disturbing the surrounding mud? For years, a satisfying explanation remained elusive. Early theories centered on wind. It was proposed that a combination of rain, which would turn the top layer of mud into a slick, greasy surface, and the extremely powerful winds that can whip through the valley, would be enough to push the rocks. However, this model had problems. Wind speeds required to move the larger stones would have to be in excess of 150 kilometers per hour. Yet such winds would likely disturb the entire surface of the playa, not just the area around the rock's track. Furthermore, it didn't explain the synchronized movements or the sharp turns. Other, more esoteric theories emerged. Some suggested the movement was caused by strange magnetic fluctuations in the area. Others proposed the rocks were being pushed along by sheets of ice, though the scorching temperatures of Death Valley made this seem unlikely. The lack of a definitive answer, combined with the playa's extreme isolation, lent the place an almost supernatural aura. The stones became characters in a silent geological drama, their movements a secret language written on the desert floor. The puzzle was finally and elegantly solved in the winter of 2013-2014 by a team of researchers from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. After years of failed attempts to capture the movement, they set up a high-resolution weather station and placed GPS-enabled dummy rocks on the playa. What they discovered was a rare and perfect convergence of conditions. First, a rare rainfall had to occur, just enough to cover the playa with a few inches of water, deep enough to allow floating ice to form but shallow enough to leave the rocks exposed. Then temperatures at night had to drop low enough for this water to freeze, forming a thin, windowpane sheet of ice around the rocks. When the sun came out the next day, the ice began to melt and break up into large, floating panels. At the same time, a light, steady breeze of just 10 to 15 kilometers per hour would begin to blow across the playa. This gentle wind was not pushing the rocks themselves, but the enormous panels of ice they were embedded in. The ice acted like a sail, catching the wind and dragging the rocks along with it. The rock, acting as a keel, would then carve the now famous tracks into the soft mud below the water. This mechanism explained everything: the low wind speeds, the parallel tracks caused by rocks caught in the same ice sheet, and the sharp turns caused by the ice sheet breaking or changing direction. In December 2013 and January 2014, the team's GPS units and time-lapse cameras recorded the event in action, capturing dozens of rocks on their slow, majestic journey across the playa, some moving up to 15 feet per minute. The mystery of the sailing stones wasn't paranormal. It was a beautiful, rare piece of physics, a dance of water, ice, and wind in one of the harshest environments on the planet, the Great Serpent Mound, Ohio, USA. In the rolling hills of rural Adams County, Ohio, lies the largest surviving prehistoric effigy mound in the world. It is not a burial mound in the traditional sense, containing no tombs or human remains. Instead, it is a work of landscape art, a masterpiece of ancient engineering that depicts a massive, undulating serpent nearly a quarter of a mile long, slithering across a high plateau overlooking a river. This is the Great Serpent Mound, and for all its grandeur, its precise purpose, its creators, and its symbolism remain subjects of intense debate and speculation among archaeologists and historians. The scale of the serpent is best appreciated from the air. From head to tail, it measures 411 meters, 1,348 feet in length, with an average height of about 1 meter. The serpent's body winds back and forth in 7 distinct coils, culminating in a triple-coiled tail at the western end. The most enigmatic feature is its head. The serpent's open jaws appear to be closing around a large, hollow, oval feature, which has been variously interpreted as an egg, the sun, or the body of a frog or other animal. In front of the head is a distinct triangular-shaped mound. The entire earthwork was constructed with meticulous care, its curves smooth and its form perfectly proportioned, suggesting a detailed plan was laid out before a single basket of soil was moved. Determining who built the mound and when has been a challenge. For many years, it was attributed to the Adena culture, which flourished in the region from roughly 800 BCE to 100 CE. However, more recent radiocarbon dating of charcoal found within the mound has yielded conflicting results. Some samples date to the Adena period, around 300 BC, while others date to the Fort Ancient culture, around 1100 CE, a gap of over 1,000 years. This has led to the theory that the mound was either built by the Fort Ancient people, Or perhaps it was built by the Adena and later refurbished or modified by the Fort Ancient Culture. Without definitive artifacts, the identity of the original architects remains uncertain. Even more mysterious is the mound's purpose. The most compelling theories link it to astronomy. The head of the serpent aligns with the summer solstice sunset, while the tail points to the winter solstice sunrise. Other alignments seem to correspond to the equinoxes. This suggests the mound may have functioned as a vast celestial calendar, used to mark the changing of the seasons, which would have been crucial for an agricultural society. Another astronomical theory connects the serpent's curves to the constellations. Some researchers have proposed that the seven coils mirror the shape of the constellation Draco, with the pole star situated near the serpent's head. In this interpretation, the mound is a terrestrial map of the heavens. The symbolism of the serpent itself is also a source of rich speculation. In many ancient cultures, serpents were powerful symbols, often associated with life, death, and rebirth due to their ability to shed their skin. A serpent eating an egg could represent the cycle of creation, the struggle between life and death, or the swallowing of the sun during an eclipse. Indeed, some researchers have noted that the head of the serpent aligns with the setting sun on the summer solstice, suggesting a cosmological drama being played out on the landscape. The lack of any burials within the mound suggests its function was purely ceremonial or communal. It may have been a place of pilgrimage, a site for rituals tied to the changing seasons, or a totem representing the spiritual beliefs of an entire people. It was a sacred place meant to be seen by the gods in the sky as much as by the people on the ground. The Great Serpent Mound endures as a profound and beautiful mystery, a silent, earthen testament to the sophisticated cosmological understanding of a people who left us no words, only this magnificent serpentine question mark written upon the land, the door to hell Turkmenistan. In the heart of the vast Karakum Desert in Turkmenistan, there is a hole in the earth that has been on fire for over 50 years. It is a fiery, roaring crater, 70 meters, 230 feet wide, and 30 meters, 100 feet deep, where thousands of flames dance and lick at the desert air, creating a spectacle of terrifying and mesmerizing beauty. Known officially as the Darvaza Gas Crater, it has been aptly nicknamed the Door to Hell. This is not an ancient or natural mystery, but a modern one. A story of geological miscalculation, unintended consequences, and the creation of a unique, man-made wonder that burns with no end in sight. The crater's origin dates back to 1971. At the time, Turkmenistan was part of the Soviet Union, and Soviet geologists were in the Karakum Desert, prospecting for oil and natural gas. They identified a site they believed was a substantial oil field and began drilling. However, they had not drilled into a solid pocket of oil, but rather a cavernous underground pocket of natural gas. The ground beneath their heavy drilling rig and equipment collapsed, swallowing the entire camp into a deep, gas-filled sinkhole. Miraculously, no lives were lost in the initial collapse. The geologists were now faced with a new and dangerous problem. A massive crater was leaking huge quantities of methane gas into the atmosphere. Methane is not only flammable but also a potent greenhouse gas and can be toxic in high concentrations, posing a threat to any local wildlife and nearby villages. Fearing the spread of poisonous gas, the scientists made a fateful decision. They decided to light the crater on fire. Their reasoning was that the gas would burn off in a few weeks and the problem would be solved. It was a spectacular miscalculation. They had no idea of the sheer scale of the natural gas reserves they had tapped into. The fire they started in 1971 has been burning continuously ever since. For decades, the Door to Hell was a little-known oddity, a secret of the Soviet Union hidden in the vastness of the desert. After the fall of the USSR and the independence of Turkmenistan, the story of the crater began to spread, and it slowly transformed from an industrial accident into a bizarre tourist attraction. The site is truly otherworldly, especially at night. The glow from the crater can be seen from miles away, a fierce orange beacon in the pitch-black desert. Up close, the roar of the flames and the intense heat create a primal, hellish experience. The crater has also, unexpectedly, become a unique ecosystem. intrepid explorers and scientists have ventured into the inferno, protected by heat-resistant suits. They have discovered that certain types of extremophilic bacteria are not only surviving, but thriving at the bottom of the crater, living in the superheated, methane-rich environment. This has raised fascinating questions about the limits of life and the possibility of life existing in similar harsh conditions on other planets. The future of the door to hell is uncertain. The Turkmen government has, on several occasions, announced plans to extinguish the fire and seal the crater, both to stop the continuous waste of valuable natural gas resources and to prevent further environmental damage. However, the technical challenge of putting out such a massive underground fire is immense and costly. For now, the fire burns on. It stands as a powerful and humbling monument to human fallibility, a stark reminder that sometimes, when we attempt to control nature, we can inadvertently create something far more powerful, enduring, and mysterious than we ever intended. It is a man-made hellscape that has, over time, acquired a wild and untamable beauty of its own, the Kotshabib Jordan. Stretching across the arid, windswept plains of southern Jordan is an archaeological enigma that has remained almost entirely unknown to the outside world. It is a structure far older and, in its own way, more mysterious than the famous walls of Hadrian or Berlin. Known as the Kotshabib, it is a faint, meandering line of stones, a low, crumbling wall that runs for an astonishing 150 kilometers, 93 miles, across the landscape. Despite its immense scale, its age, purpose, and builders are a complete mystery. It is a ghost wall, a monumental structure hiding in plain sight. The Kotshabib, which translates roughly to Shebib's Wall or Shebib's Rope, was first documented by diplomats and pilots in the early 20th century. But it wasn't systematically studied until recently, using aerial photography and satellite imaging. The research has revealed a structure of remarkable complexity. It is not a single, continuous wall, but a network of walls with branches, spurs, and sections that run in parallel. In some areas, it is a crude, low pile of unworked field stones, barely a meter high and half a meter wide. In other areas, it appears more robust, with sections that incorporated larger boulders and followed the contours of the land with deliberate precision. Dotted along its length are the remains of what appear to be small stone towers or watchposts, roughly 2 to 4 meters in diameter. The first and most obvious question is its purpose. Was it a defensive fortification? This seems unlikely. For most of its length, the wall is simply too low and too crudely built to have stopped a determined enemy. It lacks the features of a true military barrier, such as ditches, ramparts, or well-fortified gates. Its meandering path often ignores easily defensible high ground, suggesting that military strategy was not the primary concern of its builders. Another theory is that it was a political or territorial boundary, a line drawn on the land to demarcate the territory of one tribe or kingdom from another. This is more plausible. A low wall, while not a military obstacle, would have served as a clear and unambiguous marker, a statement of ownership and control. It could have been used to regulate the movement of people and livestock, or to define the limits of a political entity that has long since vanished from the historical record. Perhaps the most compelling theory is that the Kotshabib was agricultural. The wall could have been part of a massive landscape-scale system for managing resources. In an arid environment, controlling the movement of grazing animals like sheep and goats would have been essential to prevent overgrazing and protect fragile pasture land. The wall could have been an ancient fence, a way to keep domestic herds in and wild animals out, or to separate different flocks. This would explain its meandering, non-military path, as it would have followed the most logical lines for pastoral management rather than defense. The greatest mystery of all is its age. No pottery, no tools, and no inscriptions have been found in direct association with the wall that could definitively date its construction. Based on its weathered state and the style of the associated stone towers, archaeologists have tentatively dated it to the Nabataean, see, 300 BCE, 100 CE, or perhaps even the late Iron Age, see, 1000 BCE. But this is largely guesswork. The wall could be much older, a remnant of a forgotten kingdom from the early Bronze Age. The name Kotshabib itself offers no clues, as it is likely a much later Bedouin name attributed to a legendary hero, with no connection to the wall's original builders. The Kot Shebib is a profound puzzle. It is a monumental undertaking requiring the organization of a vast workforce over a huge area, yet it was built by a people who left no other trace of their existence. It is a silent, sprawling structure that asks a simple question to the empty desert. Why? The catacombs of Paris, France. Beneath the romantic, bustling streets of Paris lies another, darker city. A silent, subterranean world of tunnels and caverns that holds the skeletal remains of more than 6 million people. This is the Paris Catacombs, one of the world's largest ossuaries. While a small, sanitized section is a famous tourist attraction, it represents only a tiny fraction of a sprawling 200-mile-long network of ancient limestone quarries that snakes unpredictably beneath the city. The true mystery of the catacombs lies not in the bones we can see, but in the vast, unmapped, and forbidden labyrinth that remains, a place of secrets, modern subcultures, and profound psychological weight. The origin of the catacombs was a matter of public health and necessity. By the late 18th century, Paris's city cemeteries, particularly the central Les Innocents, were overflowing. They were a source of disease, contaminating the water supply and posing a serious threat to the population. In 1786, a decision was made to condemn the city's cemeteries and transfer their contents to the abandoned Tombe-Issoire limestone quarries, which had existed since Roman times. For decades, a grim procession took place night after night as wagons loaded with bones, skulls, and decaying flesh made their way from the city's graveyards to their new subterranean home. Priests chanted and prayed as millions of Parisians, from nobles to peasants, were unceremoniously mixed together in the dark. Initially, the bones were simply dumped in heaps. It was not until the early 19th century that the director of the quarry inspections, Louis-Étienne Héricard de Thury, undertook the project of transforming the chaotic bone piles into the macabre artistic displays we see today. Skulls and femurs were arranged into decorative walls, patterns, and crosses, interspersed with poetic and philosophical inscriptions about life, death, and mortality. The famous sign at the entrance, "Arrête, c'est ici l'Empire de la Mort! Stop, this is the Empire of Death!" sets a tone of solemn, romantic horror. The true modern mystery, however, begins where the public tour ends. The vast majority of the quarry network is officially illegal to enter, a dangerous and unstable maze of unmarked tunnels, sudden collapses, and deep, water-filled pits. This has not stopped a dedicated and secretive subculture of urban explorers known as cataphiles. For generations, these explorers have found secret entrances through manholes, sewer grates, and forgotten cellars to access the forbidden city below. They are not mere thrill-seekers. Many are amateur historians, cartographers, and artists who have taken it upon themselves to explore, map, and even inhabit this hidden world. Deep within the network, cataphilos have created their own secret society. They have established hidden cinemas, complete with electricity and seating. They have built bars, art galleries, and libraries. They hold secret parties, concerts, and clandestine meetings. They navigate using their own hand-drawn maps, which are far more detailed than any official city records, and they follow a strict code of ethics. Leave no trace, respect the dead, and never reveal the location of entrances to outsiders. In 2004, Parisian police, conducting a training exercise, stumbled upon one of these secret cinemas, fully equipped up and operational, only to find it completely vanished a few days later, with only a note left behind that read, "Do not try to find us." The catacombs represent a profound psychological space. It is a physical manifestation of the city's subconscious, a repository of its repressed history and its dead. To enter the forbidden network is to step outside of time and law, into a world governed by its own rules. The mystery is ongoing. What other secret communities exist in the darkness? What historical or archaeological treasures lie undiscovered in the unmapped tunnels? The catacombs are more than just an ossuary. They are a living, breathing underworld, a testament to the human need to explore the dark, to create community in the most unlikely of places, and to live secretly and defiantly within the empire of the dead. The Devil's Sea, Japan. In the vast expanse of the Pacific Ocean, south of Tokyo, lies a stretch of water that has earned a reputation as sinister and deadly as its Atlantic counterpart, the Bermuda Triangle. Known to Japanese fishermen as the Ma no Umi, or the Devil's Sea, and to the wider world as the Dragon's Triangle, this area has been the subject of chilling tales of ghost ships, vanished planes, and inexplicable magnetic anomalies for centuries. It is a place where modern naval technology and ancient maritime folklore collide, creating a persistent and unsettling mystery. The Dragon's Triangle is loosely defined, an area centered around Miyake Island, about 100 kilometers south of Tokyo, and stretching between the coast of Japan and the Bonin Islands. Like the Bermuda Triangle, it is one of 12 vile vortices proposed by the writer and paranormal enthusiast Ivan T. Sanderson, who believed these specific locations around the globe were centers of strange electromagnetic disturbances responsible for unexplained disappearances. The lore surrounding the Devil's Sea is rich and terrifying. For centuries, Japanese sailors have told stories of phantom ships sailing through the Fosse, of being drawn off course by an unseen force, and of fellow vessels vanishing without a trace, leaving behind no wreckage, no oil slicks, and no survivors. The name Dragon's Triangle comes from ancient Chinese legends of enormous dragons living in palaces beneath the waves, rising to the surface to snatch ships and drag them to their doom. The mystery gained international attention in the post-World War II era. Between 1952 and 1954, 5 Japanese military vessels disappeared in the Devil's Sea with a loss of over 700 lives. The most famous of these incidents was the disappearance of the research vessel Kayo Maru No. 5 in September 1952. The ship, crewed by 31 scientists and sailors, was sent by the Japanese government specifically to investigate the reports of other vanished ships in the area. It, too, disappeared without a distress call. A small amount of wreckage was eventually found, but the fate of the ship and its crew has never been determined. This event led the Japanese government to officially declare the area a danger zone for shipping. Proponents of a paranormal explanation point to these disappearances as proof of something deeply unnatural at work. Theories range from portals to other dimensions and alien abductions to advanced, unknown weapons technology left over from a lost civilization. The reports of compasses spinning wildly and electronic equipment failing are cited as evidence of extreme magnetic anomalies, far beyond what can be explained by normal geological variations. However, scientists and maritime experts offer a range of compelling natural explanations. The region of the Devil's Sea is one of the most geologically active places on the planet. It sits atop the Pacific Ring of Fire, a hotbed of undersea volcanoes and seismic activity. A sudden, violent undersea eruption could easily sink a ship or create a tsunami that would leave no trace. The seabed in this area is also rich in methane hydrates, frozen deposits of methane gas. A sudden shift in temperature or pressure could cause these hydrates to destabilize, releasing enormous bubbles of gas to the surface. This phenomenon, known as a gas blowout, would instantly lower the density of the water, causing any ship floating above to lose buoyancy and sink in seconds. Furthermore, the weather in the Dragon's Triangle is notoriously violent and unpredictable. The area is a breeding ground for typhoons and rogue waves, colossal, spontaneous waves far larger than normal sea swells that can reach heights of over 30 meters, 100 feet. A rogue wave of that magnitude could capsize even the largest of modern ships, breaking it apart and sending it to the bottom before a distress signal could be sent. Skeptics argue that the number of disappearances in the Devil's Sea is not statistically significant when compared to the massive volume of shipping traffic that passes through the region. They contend that the mystery is a product of sensationalism, a collection of unrelated maritime accidents that have been woven together into a compelling but fictional narrative. Yet for the families of those lost and for the sailors who still navigate those waters with a sense of dread, the Devil's Sea remains a place of profound and deadly power, a patch of ocean where the dragons of legend and the demons of science seem to swim side by side. The ruins of Great Zimbabwe, deep in the heart of southern Africa, on a plateau between the Zambezi and Limpopo rivers, stand the ruins of a magnificent stone city that was, for centuries, the capital of a vast and wealthy empire. These are the ruins of Great Zimbabwe, the largest ancient stone structures south of the Sahara. For over a century, the very existence of this sophisticated, monumental city was treated as a profound mystery, not because of a lack of evidence, but because of a deeply ingrained prejudice that refused to accept the truth of its origin. The mystery of Great Zimbabwe was not who built it, but why the world worked so hard to invent a mystery in the first place. The site is breathtaking. It covers nearly 1,800 acres and is divided into three main areas. The Hill Complex, a series of stone enclosures built around the natural granite boulders of a high hill, is believed to have been the city's religious and royal center. The Valley Complex is a series of compounds where the city's elite and artisans lived. But the most spectacular structure is the Great Enclosure. It is a massive, elliptical wall, over 250 meters in circumference and reaching a height of 11 meters, built with over a million expertly cut granite blocks, all assembled without the use of mortar. The precision of the stonework, particularly the elegant chevron pattern that runs along the top of the wall, is a testament to incredible skill. Inside the Great Enclosure stands the enigmatic conical tower, a solid 18-foot-high stone structure whose purpose remains unknown. When European hunters and explorers first encountered the ruins in the late 19th century, they were stunned. They could not, or would not, believe that such a sophisticated city could have been built by native Africans. In the racist colonial mindset of the era, it was simply impossible. This gave birth to the mystery of Great Zimbabwe. A host of fantastical theories were proposed to explain its existence. It was attributed to ancient Phoenicians, to Egyptians, to Arabs, even to the legendary King Solomon, who, according to one theory, built it to house the Queen of Sheba. These theories had no basis in archaeological evidence. They were born of a colonial narrative that sought to deny the history and achievements of the African people. Archaeologists and fortune hunters, operating under this flawed premise, descended on the site. They dug indiscriminately, destroying priceless evidence of the true culture in their search for non-African artifacts that would prove their theories. They removed layers of stratigraphy, discarded local pottery and tools, and left a legacy of destruction that has hampered research ever since. The truth, however, was always there, waiting in the very stones themselves. Decades of proper scientific archaeology, pioneered by figures like David Randall McIver and Gertrude Caton Thompson, have definitively and irrefutably proven that Great Zimbabwe was built by the ancestors of the modern Shona people between the 11th and 15th centuries CE. It was the capital of the Kingdom of Zimbabwe, a major trading power that grew rich on the region's gold. Artifacts found at the site, from Chinese porcelain and Persian glass to Arab coins, show that it was a thriving hub in a vast intercontinental trade network. The famous soapstone bird carvings found at the site, which have become a national symbol of modern Zimbabwe, are unique to the local culture. The construction techniques, the pottery, the skeletal remains, every piece of physical evidence points to an indigenous African origin. The mystery was a deliberate fabrication, a tool of colonial propaganda designed to justify white rule by erasing black history. The real story of Great Zimbabwe is not one of mystery, but of a powerful, innovative, and wealthy African civilization that flourished for centuries. The odd why in this case is a question directed at ourselves. Why are some histories so easily accepted, while others are so fiercely denied? Great Zimbabwe stands today not only as a monument to a great African kingdom, but also as a powerful and enduring rebuke to the prejudice that tried and failed to steal its story.